show.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Now, this story of your life is remarkable. Now, there would be some people that wouldn't be aware of the story behind what would be the forces that would drive you to make the dangerous journey to Australia. Can you just tell us a little bit about the sort of fateful day where you had to make a sort of choice that no doctor should have to make?
Well, look, it was an ordinary day. I didn't expect what's going to happen. I went to theatre like any other day and waiting for the elective list to start. And then all of a sudden, we were confronted with 3 busloads of army deserters, escorted by the Republican Guards and Ba'ath Party members. And they ordered us to abandon the elective list and start mutilating these people by chopping part of their ears off. The head of the department refused. And he said, this is against the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm. And the Ba'ath Party members and the Republican Guards dragged him out to the car park, put a bullet in his head, and then they turned to the rest of us and they said, well, now we attracted your attention. Anyone share this man's view, come forward, otherwise proceed with our orders. That was the most challenging moment in my life. I had to make a decision. Should I obey the commands and live with guilt for the rest of my life? Should I refuse and end up with a bullet in my head? Or should I run away? And I decided to escape. From there onward, I became a fugitive, running away from Saddam's regime. And then I had to hide in a female toilet for 5 hours until they left. Then from there, I took a taxi to the outskirts of Baghdad, where I met a friend of mine who took me to a farm in the western part of Iraq. And with the help of my family, they managed to get me a large sum of money, a passport that until this day, I don't know whether it was a legitimate passport or not. And they smuggled me through the borders to Jordan.
So this also, then when you arrived in Australia, would also include 9 months in the detention centre?
Ten months,
and you were referred to just as number 982.
Yep.
So how difficult was it to sort of survive in this sort of condition?
Look, the detention centre was like hell on earth. I was singled out as a ringleader and troublemaker inside the detention centre. So as a result of that, I had the pleasure of spending significant time in Western Australian prisons, including maximum security prison. And I can tell you the difference. The prison system in Western Australia is absolutely brilliant. It was like heaven compared to the detention centre, which was hell.
Let's take you to your career as a young doc in Australia. You trained in orthopedics. Can you tell us what was it that drew you towards this as a specialization?
Look, I always had passion for reconstructive surgery. That passion started at the age of 12 in 1984 when I watched the movie The Terminator, and it was fascinating to me how a human can mend with a machine and become one part. And from there onward, I decided to do medicine and I decided to do reconstructive surgery. And I'm very lucky to be here in Australia, and I managed to get my qualification recognized and managed to get into the orthopedic training program, and I finished as an orthopedic surgeon.
So your specialty is osseointegration. Can you tell us a little bit about this approach? I mean, I've got a sort of crude description of it sort of being sort of a fusion of artificial implants. Did you want to sort of elaborate on?
So my day-to-day work is hip and knee arthroplasty, which is pretty much standard practice of surgery, but I have a great deal of passion for reconstructive surgery, and a big part of that is osseointegration surgery. Osseointegration surgery is a cutting-edge technology. It's very outside the box. It's a technology that involves revolutionizing the management of amputees by bonding them with robots, and that's by inserting a high tensile strength titanium implant into the residual limb of an amputee and reorganizing the muscles around the implant and to operate a prosthetic robot. And with upper limbs, we rejig the nerves as well and hook them up with the myoelectric prosthesis. So it becomes mind control technology where a person think about moving their finger and they do move the finger. And by accident, we discovered that these people, when we reorganize their nerves, they don't just generate the power to operate the myoelectric prosthesis, but they also develop the sensory feedback. So we're working on developing sensory pods in the fingers of the robot to give the feeling back.
Does it emulate like a tactile?
Well, it's not just touch. It's more, it can give you a tactile feeling as well as pressure. Mm-hmm. So when a person holds a plastic glass, they wouldn't squash it. And the same thing happens with lower limb, which we practice, is getting the feedback from the ground. So people who utilize osseointegration technology, they get the sensory feedback from the ground. So when they walk on surfaces, they recognize these surfaces. So they can recognize the difference between a carpet or sand or tiles, etc. And there is no excuse for anyone to step on their partner's toes anymore.
So this is like a big improvement on sort of the old sort of models of prosthetics. And
this is a massive improvement on the old models. The old models have very significant problems with the socket-mounted prosthesis, where it has skin frictions and its problems associated with it, such as blisters, heat, irritations, infections, rubbing, chafing, all of these problems with the socket. Also, the mobility and the fit, where the body of a human being changes in size during the day. So in the morning, the limb is much smaller than at the end of the day. So while with the socket-mounted prosthesis, it's one size. So a person feels uncomfortable as the day go by, and by the end of the day, when they take the socket off, they can't put it back on because their limb is too swollen. And what I mentioned before is the osteoperception, or the feeling of the ground, is a huge advantage, where allowed a lot of our amputees to regain back their activity and mobility and return back to the workforce.
So having established yourself as a surgeon in Australia, mm-hmm. you performed a lot of volunteer work in Cambodia and in Iraq. Can you tell us, what's it like to be able to sort of provide healthcare to people that not have access to?
Look, I always dedicated significant portion of my year for volunteer work. From childhood, I was helping out with donations and helping families to build houses, etc. And as I grew up, charity work is always an integral part of my life. You know, we do a lot of routine work in our day-to-day jobs, and the world needs a lot of help. You know, not just developing countries, but developed countries as well. So I travel around one third of the year to many countries to help out with establishing either osseointegration centers in developed countries or helping out in developing countries such as Southeast Asia, like Cambodia. We have pilot study Middle East, like Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq. And I've been to Iraq 6 times. And I'm going back in 2 weeks' time. And the whole aim is to operate as much as possible on as many people as possible that need the surgery, because these countries have been deprived of skills. And the other benefit is to help training the local staff over there so they can carry on surgeries that we do. And the third is to build the infrastructure. And I take a lot of equipment with me. There are a lot of generous donors that help us with equipment, such as I just received a donation from Norwest Private Hospital, which was very kind, with a set of instruments for trauma gear. And that's a huge help, because people in these countries lack not just the expertise, but also the infrastructure that is significantly needed to help reconstructing these people's lives.
And also, this is the actual equipment itself. The osseointegration equipment itself is actually quite expensive for people in the world to be able to afford. So the actual limbs themselves, are there ways of trying to provide this sort of access?
Well, at the moment, I donate these equipment to the Iraqi people or the Cambodian people or people in the countries in Southeast Asia. Time will come where I'll run out of resources. So that's why we established our foundation, to help amputees around the world in areas where they need that, to provide them with the equipment. And I'm sure there is a lot of generosity in people that would want to help. And as I said, again, we never have significant problems getting the help that we need from donors with equipment and tools.
So your book is called Going Back. It's very much about your journey back to Iraq. So what was it like returning to a country that you fled 2 decades ago?
Look, I must admit, the first time I went back to Iraq, I was very concerned. Not so much about my welfare. I had Michelle and Claudia, my PA, and my partner with me. And I'm a risk taker. You know, I go into dangerous places all the time. But these young girls who kindly volunteered to come with me, not knowing what they're going to face, I was very worried about them, especially when the plane was landing. But my fears all dispersed very quickly as soon as I met people, and I could see that there is a lot of goodness inside the locals. Still, people are good people, and still they very appreciative of people who are coming to help them, and regardless of their backgrounds and ethnicity and nationality. And basically, we are treated very well in Iraq. However, the place is still a mess. There is a lot of dangers in the region, especially with the rise of religious fanatics and considering then I'm very outspoken against all sorts of extremism, such as Islamic fundamentalist ideologies or white supremacy or Nazis.
Sadly, and you just saw what the impact of that just 2 weeks ago.
To me, I regard all these kind of extremists, whether they are right-wing fundamentalists or they are Islamic fundamentalists, they are two faces of the same coin, basically.
So you must get enormous satisfaction being able to return mobility to your patients. What's it like when you monitor the progress of your patients? Do you get a really good feeling when you get to see how their lives have improved?
Look, I mean, you do your best for your patients and you hope for the best. And sometimes it goes perfectly well and sometimes the results are less than favorable, and unfortunately that is life, but it does affect me if I don't get good results. But I strive to fix the problem and make sure that people end up with good results. And you know, there is nothing more satisfying and more rewarding than seeing a smile of a child when they see their parent walking again after being in a wheelchair for many years. That means the world for me, and basically it is what keep me going, because let's face it, the way we do our job and the way we work, it's very stressful, and you face a lot of difficulties in many aspects, and there's still a lot of resistance to what we do from within the fraternity, and sometimes you take a step back and you think that, is it worth it that I keep going? But then the minute I see another patient who's very happy and their family are happy and the life has changed, then you straight away think again and you say, no, I'll keep going because it's worth it.
There was recently a foreign correspondent about your visit to Iraq. One of the most memorable people to visit was Amani Nasser Jabbar, a champion Paralympic athlete. How is she faring?
Well, look, Amani is a great example of what can happen to a person. This young girl lost her legs at the age of 9. You know, a lot of people have someone to support them. And when I go to Iraq, there are either people who belong to the military or the paramilitary or the police or the secret services or the expats from the Ministry of Health. But Amani was a unique patient in the sense that she didn't have anyone that she belonged to, and she was alone. And nobody wanted to care about her. And so she came to me and I faced massive amount of struggle trying to, number one, be allowed to operate. And nobody funded her. So I had to donate everything for her, from the prosthesis and the implants. And then finally, we managed to get her legs because the government didn't care about her in Iraq. So I had my prosthetist, Stefan Lox, he kindly donated 2 robotic legs for her. And she's walking again now. And there is a movie about her now in Iraq, and she's becoming very famous. So she lost both legs above the knee, and for the first time in many years, she's walking again. And I just saw some captions from Facebook about the movie that was just released now in Iraq about her.
And I believe in your youth, you had an interest in radio broadcasting. You did a little bit of underground radio.
Yeah, we were very naughty kids. I mean, we're talking about the times in the 80s. That was way before internet. Computer technology was very primitive and there was a lot of spare time on our hands. So we were very experimental, and my cousin and I were kind of nerdy boys who tried to experiment with. I had a speak and spell machine, which is a machine that pronounce things, and we had a book of how to make radios, and we had a few transistors and amplifiers, and we managed to make a local radio station, basically. Mind you, radio stations in Iraq are prohibited. It was only the government radio stations, so very quickly you could hear the sirens and of police trying to look for this broadcasting. It was not that far. I think we broadcasted a radius of a kilometer or something, but obviously people could hear it, and it was very experimental. It was fun, but very dangerous, because if we got arrested, we would be in the pickle.